So hi, everybody. Welcome to Attempted Adults Live, which is super exciting. For those who don't know, well, I'm assuming you know, but Attempted Adults is a podcast that Chris and I co-host, and we are doing a live episode today from Amherst College, which is super cool. We both work at Smith College, so neighbors, but I live in Amherst and hang out at Amherst College a lot with my dog. So, you know, it's all good. We wander through campus randomly. I don't know if that's weird. But thank you all so much for coming. And yeah, welcome to Attempted Adults with Anna and Chris.
Welcome. I'm Chris. She took up my space. I couldn't even say anything.
You said your name. You can say my name.
Anna.
Ooh, not like that.
Okay. So, Attempted Adults, we muddle through adulthood together. And Anna and I have been doing this podcast for about 10 months now, I would say. We're on our 11th episode, which would be the live show is actually our 12th, I believed. And we try to figure things out along the way. We don't get it right all the time. We don't even really like each other all the time, but mostly we do. And we agree and we disagree. And we try to make sure that while we're talking about issues that affect us, that it is also things that affect the students that we work with and students from around the country. So thank you. Today, we are specifically talking about what?
We're talking about activism and burnout and leadership and adulthood and life, all of those things, just like a casual, light conversation about, you know, some nice, easy topics. So what we're going to do is we are going to talk about activism and burnout. We're going to talk about some strategies that can be used to combat burnout from engaging in the political process, in activist work, in whatever way that you might be engaging with the world around us right now. And then we'll open the floor for adulting questions on any topic.
Before we hop right in, we should be pretty transparent with our very big crowd that usually we take time to do our podcast. We don't like write it all out. Like we do have a little script that we like write a few ideas down, but it's kind of as we feel it as we go. And we have a lovely, amazing human who usually helps edit it through. So you guys get to bear with us as we like figure this out with you all. It is also our first live show. So just be mindful of that and forgive us and we'll forgive you. And be happy and loud and exciting with us if there's a moment to be that.
And we'll try not to swear quite as much as we do. That normally gets edited out.
Great. Okay. So, let's see. Political climate and activism. It's really, really hard today, I think, to be a human in society because the world is on fire, literally. Like, everything is going wrong. And we are trying to figure out how, as young people, we can live and thrive in this space. And I think as a college human, it's even harder to be living and breathing and learning and working and also managing financial crises and all of these different things. And at the same time, trying to be activists. I was doing some research on this topic and trying to figure out, well, is it even our role? Is it our job to be socially active and to be trying to figure out how to save the world while we are young people and students and professionals? And I came across this article from the Public Religion Research Institute. And essentially, it's just about a research project that was done in 2018 that talks about civic engagement, young adult activism. And it said that 69% of Americans report that when they think about the country today, specifically about the government and just living, there's a negative emotion that they feel about it, 69%. And that negative emotion can be around sadness or anger or just plain old fear.
We tried to brainstorm all of the things that people might be stressed about or feeling burnt out about or engage with. So it was a nice light, again, conversation.
Very light.
And we really didn't even know where to start.
Government being unstable.
The world is on fire.
People feeling and being unsafe in the world and in their skin.
The world is on fire.
Mass shootings.
The world is on fire. And the oceans are rising.
Oh, yeah, the oceans. Yeah. The fish, they're dying. Financial crisis, not being able to have enough money to pay for school.
World is
loans.
On fire. World is on fire.
World is on fire.
Still on fire.
Okay. You feel sad now?
So enlightening.
So with that feeling of sadness, I think there's also this pressure to be perfect, to be a student that is getting really good grades, that is engaging with the people around them, being able to look good on social media and be a change maker, whatever the hell that means, right? To you or to the people around you. And if that means for you to be active in government things or voting or whatever, you have to figure out how do I do that and still have time to get good grades. So we're here to think about harmony.
So when we think about student activism and student protests, there was a, so I'm a big fan of studies, big fan of like being able to drive my points home with data.
Nerd.
Yep, it's fine. I've accepted it about myself. So in 2016, there was a UCLA survey of undergraduates nationwide that found that 1 in 10 college students expected to partake in protests while in college. And that is the highest rate seen since 1967. 1967, keep in mind, was like the peak of student protest, right? We had the Greensboro sit-ins, we had the formation of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, we had Vietnam protests, we had Kent State, we had all this stuff coming to a head during like a 3-year span, 5-year span, maybe. Since that point in 1967, the numbers have gone down, 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 and then recently they've spiked back up, right? So they've spiked up around issues like gun control and guns on campus. They've spiked up around our environment and the world we live in. They've spiked up around things like Black Lives Matter, right? This has come all up, similar to how it did in 1967, or roughly, come back up around all these different issues. So continuing my nerd out, there's that. More students are engaging in student protest and activist work in college. The second pile is around activist burnout, right? And we're going to put these together. So research is showing that people who engage in social justice work burn out quickly and in a different way than just your normal career burnout, life burnout, right? There's a different type of burnout, and your body is impacted differently.
So before I talk about why I think that burnout is a little bit different for activists, I am the wellness director at Smith, and I study things like burnout, and I study harmony, and I study what I call wholeness, which is how do you bring together the whole being and make sure that they're living and thriving and being successful in their community. You'll hear more about that in like 2 weeks. But Anna here studies leadership, and I think that activism is a really big part of leadership. And so I wondered, before we talked about burnout, if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I'm a leadership development designer at Smith College. And so that what that means is that I create opportunities for students to develop leadership skills in some capacity. And that's been my career area for my whole career. So in terms of activism and leadership, I think it's really interesting. Activist movements aren't one person, right? They are comprised of social change movements, aren't one person. They're comprised of many people combining their powers, working together, and playing to their strengths in different ways, right? So when we think about these movements, often have a figurehead. They often have one person at the front who maybe is on the cover of the newspaper, or they have multiple people, right? It's kind of the classic of example of Rosa Parks didn't decide to sit in the front of the bus out of the blue. Right? That was part of a coordinated effort that multiple people talked about and planned. That is how activism drives leadership, right? People play different roles. Maybe for you all, you are that person who's going to be the front runner, who's going to mobilize and organize and get there. Maybe you're the person who's going to do that kind of in the back of the back or the side of the room. Both of those are just as legitimate in terms of the leadership that you are using and exhibiting and developing, but they play out in different ways. Activist and leadership are two words that are really closely tied in my opinion. I don't think that you can really have activism without leadership. And I think that it's a very legitimate form of utilizing and expressing the leadership that you believe in.
Even if I identify as an introvert and I want to be a part of a big movement and I don't want to be at the front, I can still be a leader. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that sometimes people would find you as an introvert in that group more accessible, right? Sometimes when we look at these big movements and we see just one person who's like me, who's loud and kind of obnoxious sometimes. Are you agreeing?
Yes.
Thank you. Sometimes we see them and we say like, oh, that's not attainable because my personality, my soul doesn't fit into that specific box. I also see the people who are able to just quietly do what needs to get done and bring people and organize people in certain ways as an unattainable goal. But that movement needs both of us, right? It needs the people who are going to be able to not need that spotlight and the people who are going to need the spotlight, because the work that they do is equally as important for actually making that change.
I think I decided to like go off on that divot because sometimes I struggle with this idea of leadership because I don't consider myself as someone that's particularly extroverted in a lot of ways. Like I can put it on, like I can pretend and I can like sit up here and like put on a very happy, energetic face. But then also I'm a person that like needs a lot of like space in order to get into a good headspace enough to be able to be someone that stands out in the front. So I guess I think about, as we're transitioning to think about burnout, who are you and in what personalities do you have and how do you highlight them and protect them and safeguard them so that you can be the kind of leader that you want to be?
Yeah.
Where I came from, I guess.
No, I totally agree. And I think for me, it's about asset-based learning and growth mindset, those two things coming together, right? So we should be playing to what we're really good at instead of just fixating and ruminating and spiraling on what we don't have, right? So if we can focus in on the parts of ourselves that make us rock stars, we're going to be able to go a lot further together because there's someone else who has the other things that you don't have, right? Leadership doesn't happen in a vacuum. You need people to come together. You need people to work with you, and you need to be able to get people on board with your vision. And that happens both loudly and quietly. People respond to different things.
Are you saying there's no I in team?
Don't say that again.
Okay.
You handed me a soapbox and I'd like to thank you for that.
You're welcome. Okay, so going back to this idea of burnout. So there's a lot of reasons why I think that activists deal with burnout more than other people, or just not more, but kind of at a faster rate because of a few things. And one of them is the idea that most people that are doing activist type work, they're carers. So Emily and Amelia Nagowski, they talk about in their book Burnout, the human giver and the human giver syndrome. And the idea around that is that when you're a human giver, you feel an obligation to give of your humanity and give and not really receive and fill back up. And while you're doing that, you need to do it happily, you need to do it generously, you need to be good looking, like you need to have all of that package in order to give of yourself enough. And is it ever enough? Like, can I give of myself, give of myself, give of myself, and still, like, people will want more? And they will keep demanding more of you until you say no and until you say, oh, I need to stop. But I think part of being a carer is also having that idea or having that feeling that you can't say no or that you can't actually demand anything, because somehow if you do demand something, then you're no longer the martyr that you are showing yourself to be. Like, you might not get that wonderful social justice plaque or that social justice medal, I guess, if you don't say like, okay, I need space or I need to do something for me, because you're no longer caring, you're no longer giving. And so I think that's one of the reasons. And then burnout, it's not a new term. I feel like it's very trendy right now. We're talking a lot about it, especially on college campuses. I think also like in different fields, the medical fields particularly, we're talking about medical students and we're talking about researchers and pushing and how they are facing burnout like faster than other people. But it's been around since the 1970s. And this dude, Herbert Freudenberger.
Nice job.
Thank you. Herbert Freudenberger. No, I messed
you
it up.
Well, you had to say it twice? Come on. You got it right the first time.
He said that there were three things that kind of led to burnout. And that was these three things. Emotional exhaustion. Fatigue that comes from caring too much and too long. Right? If you've ever been an activist for any particular reason or cause, emotional exhaustion, okay? Depersonalization, the depletion of empathy, caring, and compassion. And then finally, this one I think is most important, especially when it comes to young people, young professionals, and young students, is the decreased sense of accomplishment, feeling like nothing that you do is enough. You don't have to raise your hand, but if you've ever felt in your soul that nothing that you do is enough, then you know kind of like what I'm talking about, that you could be giving of the world every hour of your day and go home and be like, nothing mattered. Nothing I did mattered. And that feels like terrible. So don't feel that way. And that's why I think that burnout is a lot harder for people that are giving of themselves and being a part of causes.
So the thing I want to add is actually going back to a different study, so I can nerd in a different direction. All right, so Paul Gorski was the founder of the Equity Literacy Institute, and Paul Gorski did a study. That study found that roughly half of the activists who reported experiencing burnout, they didn't take time off or take a hiatus, they left their movements completely because they got burnt out. So instead of taking a break and taking time to find a little bit more harmony, right, they left because they couldn't do it anymore. And that's what they needed to do for themselves. Continuing that, this was even more true for those who were coming from marginalized groups who were literally fighting for their own humanity. So for the sake of social change and the sake of progress, we got to figure out this burnout thing because it's breaking our social movements. It's becoming such a deep problem that things aren't progressing forward because people are burning out. So the other thing that's interesting about social movements and social change, have any of you heard of the Stress Olympics? Do they play the Stress Olympics at Amherst College? A little bit? Yeah, big time. Yeah, we play them at Smith. We host the games every once in a while. So Stress Olympics, just to give an example in case people aren't sure, it's this constant glorification of stress and of busy.
Accurate? Example, please.
So I am happy to give you an example. Chris, did you know that I have 15 papers due this week? I have not slept in 5 days or nights, and I have only eaten coffee beans from the bag for every meal.
That's nothing. Like, you should be happy that you have that amount of time.
What?
I'm a PhD student. I work a full-time job. I run a podcast, and I also like have a jillion papers due all the time. And I've only survived on water and protein bars like once every 5 days.
At least you're drinking water. I didn't even tell you about my 7 rescue dogs that I'm trying to take care of, and they don't get along with each other, so I have to walk them all at different times. Okay, so that's Stress Olympics. Maybe a little bit exaggerated, but you get the idea, right? So when we get into these activist movements, there's also what's known as the Martyrdom Olympics, right? I'm giving more of myself. And I would say that this is really closely tied and often overlaps with the Stress Olympics, is I'm giving more of myself. I am more depleted by this, but it's because I'm being a martyr for this cause. I believe so much in this cause that I am going to hurt my well-being to make it progress. So,
and if you don't, it seems like you don't care enough.
Yeah. And what do you get when you participate in the Stress or Martyrdom Olympics? You don't get a medal. At best, you get a migraine. I'm not giving out medals.
Nausea. That's what I get.
Yeah. It's not great.
Lack of sleep. Sleep is important. I think this all feels really heady to me. And so I wonder if we could bring it down a level to kind of talk about a cause or something that you have engaged in at some point that you might be interested in talking about.
All right. So a cause I have engaged in. So for me, my current cause, so I live in Amherst. I live in this town. I live very close to here, actually. As I told you, my dog and I constantly are just wandering through. She's a big fan. One of the things that I believe really deeply in is protecting natural spaces in the world, but especially in the areas where you live. And so I engage with the town as a member of the Conservation Commission, helping to protect the natural spaces and the conserved spaces in this town. I think it's a little different because it's not necessarily a social movement, but in its own way, it's pushing a cause, right? It's just pushing a cause through, I would say, conventional and traditional methods. And so for me, I don't necessarily see that burnout in the same way, but there are slight, like maybe some slight ways that it comes in where people say like, oh, I just can't possibly do that. I have too much going on. And I think where I struggle with this is we are busy. There is legitimacy to some people saying, I can't do that, right? And we want to encourage people to be open and upfront about when they're having a challenge. And I think it's, for me, it's about finding that line of when it's crossing into busy Olympics. So it's a little different, I think, for me. It's not necessarily Stress Olympics anymore, and it's a little bit of Martyr Olympics, but it's just this glorification of busy. It's a culture of busy.
So have you ever gotten to a point where you felt like those 50% that we were talking about that would call it quits?
Mm-hmm. I mean, some people do quit. And I think that there is a point where leaving is the best option. But I think what we're talking about is almost like an early intervention, right? It's saying that maybe you wouldn't quit if we could figure out a way to deal with this burnout earlier. Maybe there's a method to keep people engaged in a new way that's healthier and safer and better. Sometimes, you said this earlier when we were talking, sometimes leaving is the option. Sometimes that's what you need in order to be a human, and that's okay. But the goal is to stop it earlier. What about you?
I don't think I've ever gotten to that point with a particular social cause. I think the one that I'm most focused on right now is around GLSEN, which is a K-12 organization that works with LGBTQIA plus youth, and making sure that they have educators that have been trained to work with them and to provide safer, braver spaces for them to live and thrive. And that is something that I feel is very important to me at my core right now. And I haven't been doing that work on the level that I'm doing it for a very long time. So I haven't gotten to a place yet of burnout, but I do feel like there is a piece of martyrdom that I feel like my being, myself, it's a little bit of pride, a little bit of hubris. That's like, if I don't do this work, who else is gonna do it? Kind of a thing. And perhaps that's just pride and that's not even true. But I think that that pushes me forward. But then there's also some days when I'm trying to get the rest of the things that I need to get done. And I also have GLSEN work to do where I feel like I should say something to the people that I'm working with and engaging with and say, you know what, I'm actually at a place right now where I can't put my best foot forward. And it would be best for me and for the cause if I could just take a break, not from the whole organization, mm-hmm. but just from this particular project.
And I think that's a really good example because it also gets at what we were talking about before, where sometimes your activist work is part of your humanity, you know? And I think that that also, for I would say most people in that group, that work that they're doing is part of who they are as a person, more so than just a core belief, it's part of who they are. Now that we've bummed you out, we want to move into what you can do about it. We do have things you can do. We've come up with a decent recipe for combating burnout. Wait, we've come up with like a fire extinguisher for burnout.
All right. Well, first, I think a really important part of burnout, and I actually run a workshop at Smith around this, and one of the things that I think students never think to do is identify the symptoms. Identify the symptoms for you, right? So we listed a couple, like migraines and headaches and feeling despondent, not loving the things that you've engaged with before, not hanging out with friends as much or hanging out with friends way too much, just avoiding everything and procrastinating, right? Whatever it is for you, you should identify what those key things are when they appear. And I always say to students, which is a separate topic about burnout, not particularly about activism, is that burnout in colleges usually appears around two times. And if I like threw it out into the crowd and was like, when does burnout appear for most students? Which 2 months? I bet you could tell me. Can anyone tell me?
I want to guess.
December and May. So close. Well, I guess it would depend on the school. For us at Smith, it's more November and April, right?
Same idea.
Pretty much around the same time. So if we know that burnout is something that we all pretty much experience, not all of us, not all at the same time, experience, why is it that we don't start to mitigate it before it happens? Why is it that we wait till we are in the middle of it, we are entrenched in it, we are in the poorest of poorest to deal with it? So number one is identify your symptoms of burnout.
I think, and also it's important to note, one, maybe your symptoms look like engaging in the stress Olympics. Two, your symptoms are going to look different than other people's, right? So what are yours? What are your, like, how do you know if you're burning out?
If I'm not sleeping well,
yeah,
that's usually the best indicator for me. If I'm getting migraines on a really regular basis.
For me, it's not sleeping well. And then also if I start to ignore the people in my life.
Like I isolation. Also get like really mean.
Oh.
I know this like really cute face that you all can see is like, how could you be mean? But I get really mean.
So what can we do? We start feeling burnt out. We know our symptoms, or we've started to figure them out by repeated experiencing of them. So what do we do? What's the first thing?
Well, that's the second thing. The second thing would be to have an accountability partner. And I usually say have two accountability partners. Why do we have two? Because number one, you could have someone that is usually your accountability partner, a friend or whatever, and they might be in a terrible place as well. And so that's not fair to them. So I always say, ask the question or like tell someone like, hey, there's something going on with me, I think. Or I usually get to a place where I don't identify for myself that I need to take a step back or I need to do something for me. And when that happens, I need you to check me. And when that time comes and you need to ask them, just ask them if they're in a good place too. Like, are you in a place where you can hear what I need to say? And if not, then person number two, right? So have accountability partners is always my second thing.
Continuing our takeaways from this, or continuing our our patterns.
Yeah.
Strategies.
Find a hobby. Find a hobby that's outside of your activist work, right? Something that has absolutely nothing to do with the cause that you are doing, and maybe even doesn't have the people that you're regularly associated with, because those people that you see all the time to do one particular thing can get really frustrating and even annoying sometimes. And my other thing would be to maintain the hygiene.
Nice.
Hygiene is very important. Please shower. Please brush your teeth.
I feel attacked. So my first thing is drink water, get some sunlight, because you're basically a houseplant with more feelings, right? Like, humans are basically just advanced houseplants. We need water. We need sunshine. You know, we like people to talk to. Plants like being sung to. I think people do too.
Mm-hmm. Create a burnout savings account or a burnout jar or something that you can go back to. And essentially, if you take some time at the front of it and just put down some cool ideas of like fun things that you want to do, like read that one chapter of Harry Potter that gets you every time and makes you feel alive, or watch that episode of whatever show like makes you feel good every single time, like putting it into a jar so that you can pull it out when you are ready and when you need it and when you are at one of your lower points, or preferably before you get to the lower of lower points.
So then the other thing I want to throw in here is to practice self-compassion. And so self-compassion is a big topic. So Kristen Neff is a faculty member at the University of Texas at Austin, and she was one of the first, if not the first, people to study and define self-compassion. So she explains that self-compassion has three elements. The first is self-kindness versus self-judgment. So self-kindness or self-compassion means being kind and understanding to ourselves when we suffer, when we fail, when we feel inadequate, rather than what our normal response is, which is to ignore our pain or critique ourselves pretty harshly, right? We're not kind to ourselves in that moment. Personally, my self-judgment of choice is rumination. This, what it means to be, to practice self-compassion and to be kind, it means working on understanding that baseline rule that messing up, that failure is part of life. And then once you kind of have that base, you can be gentler, kinder to yourself when life doesn't go how you wanted or how you expected. And failure often feels like this is like a big thing, right? Like I have to have failed at something huge. I failed on Wednesday. I was supposed to get up and go work out, and I just didn't. It just didn't happen, right? And so like, shoot, bummer. Okay, it's cool. I'll get it next time, right? And I think once we kind of can work on that base level understanding that like, it's going to happen, how we respond to it and how our initial reaction to it will slowly change. Your brain will slowly, it takes a long time, slowly learn to be kind to yourself in that moment and not just necessarily dismiss it. Sometimes you can own it. Be like, yeah, I messed that up. I'm going to work forward from this versus getting stuck in that moment. The second aspect of self-compassion is common humanity versus isolation. So we talked about this being a symptom of burnout, is you isolate, you kind of go into yourself a little bit. Frustration and failure and burnout often come with this feeling of, I'm the only person who has ever experienced and will ever experience and is currently experiencing this. And as special as you all are, that's just not true, right? You are not the only person who has moments of failure and feels down. And you're probably not even the first person to experience failure in the way that you've experienced it, right? So being open with each other, creating that culture of openness and seeking other people out to find that common humanity. And what I mean by that is just saying like, I missed the gym this morning. Has that ever happened to you?
Yes.
See, common humanity found, you know, and then we can be like, oh shoot, you want to go together next time? Like whatever. Do you want to go?
No.
Okay. Building common humanity also can really help you build hope. Understanding, and hope is this key aspect of avoiding burnout, right? Understanding that like there is a reason to keep progressing. That sounds really deep and dark, but there's continued understanding that I will get this next time. And if I don't get it next time, try again, you know? The third and final aspect of self-compassion is mindfulness versus over-identification. So mindfulness, I'm sure you've heard like 12 times today alone, because it's become this huge buzzword. But as with many buzzwords, there is legitimacy behind it. We want to try to find a harmony or a balance when feeling our feelings. if we go into processing, if we go into common humanity conversations without a sense of mindfulness, frustrations or burnt out feelings can consume us, right? We turn into over-identification ruminating machines and we just swirl around and swirl around and swirl around and go down. There's no coming up from rumination. You got to just kind of start off with this mindfulness of, oh my goodness, I am so frustrated right now. Let's think about the next step versus I'm so frustrated and I'm never not going to be frustrated and I'm going to be frustrated for the rest of my life. So sometimes it's really hard to do that mindfulness in a solar reflection and you just turn to rumination, or at least I do. So again, that common humanity comes right back in.
I think mine are less deep, but just turn off the things that are stressing you out and that you're engaging with, even if that's a social cause, right? And maybe you're used to reading about it on your social media a lot or going to a lot of marches or whatever the case may be. Just maybe take a pause from doing that for a little while and being okay with that. And then finding new ways to look out for the people that are around you that are also doing those things. Like if all of a sudden your friend that does this social cause with you starts playing, you know, only dramatic music on their Instagram with really sad song lyrics all the time, maybe check in with that person. Be kind. Be good friends. And I think that's really it. Like, don't feel like you're wrong when you have to step away from something. Don't judge yourself. But allow yourself to be what you need it to be and do what you need for yourself. That's all I got.
Yeah, and take care of each other, right? Like, look out for other people. If I start posting emotional song lyrics, I am deep down a hole. Like, that hasn't happened since I was 14 and someone needs to check on me. So I think for me, it's like encouraging my friends to go look at the stars, go look at the leaves. It's so pretty outside right now. Go outside. Houseplant. Go outside.
So to wrap it up,
again, take care of each other and understand that you're not the only person who's gone through this. Understand that, and I know sometimes just saying that is not helpful, but if you start to talk to other people about it and you experience it and understand that other people are experiencing it because you hear it from them, that common humanity, for me, out of all the things with self-compassion, that one stands out the most because I think that that is the one that we can see and we can feel at a really deep, deep level.
Cool.
All right. So phase three, we're moving on to questions and answers.
Yes. Questions.
All right. Shuffle. Okay. Question one. Oh, so this is nice. This is like a nice light one. Thank you for throwing me some softballs. What do you think are the causes of why we live in a culture and society that glorifies busyness? Solve busyness, Chris. So essentially the question is like, why are we like this, right? Like, why are we as a culture obsessed with busy? So for me, I'm going to blame capitalism on this one. Just going to go ahead and toss that one under the bus.
And the patriarchy,
which is like kind of usually my go-tos, and they're usually true. I really do. I think that we are in a culture of busy because we are in a culture of production and we're in a culture of quantity, right? And so I do think that capitalism is to blame for this one. I think that we have been taught to work as hard as you can to make as much money as you can, to make as much product as you can, to keep up with the Joneses, right? I think that that's been the message for a really long time in the US. And I think that there's so much other stuff wrapped in with that. There's like race is wrapped in with that, class is wrapped in with that, gender is wrapped in with that, because you can't ever separate one thing from all of those things. But short answer, I'm blaming capitalism.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. And I feel like we have to at some point find a reason to spend as much money as we do on school. So like you have to be busy in order for it to make sense.
Yeah, it's like that justification, you know, like that's, we justify a lot. Because
but then that's busy. Also just capitalism.
Oh, I love the second one. This is a good one. All right, what are some of your favorite nature-y places in Amherst and around the Pioneer Valley? Thank you. Oh my God, I'm going to talk for an hour.
You have
Do you want to go
two
first?
2 seconds.
Shh, you go first.
I'm not from this area. I'm from New York. So,
I mean, I went to college in New York, but I think we experienced the state very differently.
I really like Smith. That's because I don't get out very far into the natures, but I do walk around the pond there. There's a place in Leeds, which is where I live, and it's a watering hole. Maybe they don't call it a watering hole. There are no animals there. I mean, I guess there are. Never mind. But there's a water hole that I love, and like it's not really a hike. It's off a bike path. Maybe.
It is the Leeds Reservoir that she's talking about.
No, it's not, though, because that's, like, big. That's, okay. Like, a real thing. It's, like, a tiny thing probably off of the big reservoir, and it's, like, down the river. You have to walk, right? And there's, like, a little... You can't see what I'm saying, but, like, there's a thing, and you have to walk down to it. Anyway, it's really pretty. There's not usually a lot of people there, but as a woman of color who was, like, oh... I brought my mom to come and visit me, and I live in the woods now. And she was like, I feel very unsafe because there's too many trees and too many leaves and too many white people, right?
That's fair.
And so she wouldn't come down there with me. And when she did, she was like, oh, this feels like Jamaica. It feels like a place that isn't as scary as I'm making it sound in my head. So I love that place, which was a really long answer for the water hole down my house.
I love it. All right, so I'm going to just do my top three really quickly. Holyoke Range in general, but specifically Rattlesnake Knob at the Holyoke Range is a really sweet little walk up. At the end of Stanley Street, there is a swimming hole that's really fun. If you go down that way, where are we? Yep, I was right, that way. And then my other favorite spot, which is super, super easy to get. I have too many favorite spots. We'll go... with, you know, Amethyst Brook is just so pretty and it's so easy to get lost in that I really like just going there and just wandering and taking random turns. Because you know you can find your way out. Like, you know eventually you will end up out of Amethyst Brook if you keep walking. But, yeah, it's beautiful and it's calm and chill. So Holyoke Range, Stanley Street Swimming Hole, and Amethyst Brook.
Anna also took me to a mountain.
I took her to Bear Mountain, which is a large hill.
It has a mountain in the name. So... All right, next question. It says, I'm going to live with my best friend after college. How do I find harmony with being roommates and best friends?
Classic. I love it. All right. So I would say that there's a lot of things you can do. There's a lot of things you can consider. For me, it's clarifying if you can make sure that you have your own space within the shared space. That's really important. At least for me, that's been really important. So I haven't shared a space. I'm looking for a roommate right now, and I'm currently like going through this process of dreading having to share my space again. But having your own space that is just yours, so whether that's a bedroom, whether it's like an office, whatever it is, and then you gotta be really clear up front about how you're gonna communicate when issues arise so that you don't end up in the passive post-it note situation. And you have to be clear on who's going to do what, how you're contributing to the household, right? That sounds very like Florence Henderson 50s, but it's true. You need to talk about who's going to bring the trash out, or are you going to share it? Who are you sharing meals? Like, there's all of these things that you need to figure out that you can do in like a sit down over coffee.
For me, the biggest thing would be boundaries. Like, establish very clear boundaries up front, even if it's your best friend. Like, what is okay and what is not okay, and when do you need your space, and if Grey's Anatomy is on for me, like, I don't want to talk to you. Like, these kind of things are very important to make sure that your friendship is stable and that you continue to like each other after living with each other. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you live with them now on college, in a college space, but after, when the real world comes around, like...
College is still like the real world.
It's like a half real world. It's like a bubble of a world, right? But like when you have to start paying back college loans and then there's also no boundaries in your household, like things get a little rough.
Yeah, I'd say two key tenets, boundaries and establishing your routines for communication. All right, next.
Last one.
What? No.
You can Yeah, there's like five.
You gotta go fast. Oh. It's fine. Fast answers. All right, I'll read this one really quick. You paused. Some people draw energy from activism, and this can prevent burnout for longer. Is it possible to learn how to draw that energy? Oof. And then part B, what counts as activism? I feel guilty for not going to protests or making phone calls, but I do try to do things to make the world a better place. Oh, okay, I'm going to start with part one, which is what is activism? And then we'll go into how to draw energy from it. So what counts as activism? Everything, right? Activism is a spectrum. There's like little ways to engage with it. There's big ways to engage with it. There's ways to engage with it that are going to impact one person. And there's ways to engage with it that are going to impact 12,000 people, right? I think that what counts as activism is what you feel like you made some incremental movement towards progress and towards change. I don't think that there's anything that like count. There's no accrediting body of what activism is, right? It's more about, did you push the needle even incrementally, even for one person for 1 minute, right? And then they're going to go back. That's okay. That still counts because you got them to think about it. I think that if it counts for activism, it's when you feel like you did something.
Yeah. Even if it's just like signing a petition, you might not be the one who organized the petition, but if you signed it, then you put your name on something that will hopefully make some change.
And the second part of that question that's not actually the question is, I often feel guilty for not going to protests or making phone calls. And that, for me, feels like it goes back to that glorification of busy, and it goes back to that glorification of martyrdom, right? And so if we feel there is so much we're not doing, if we allow that guilt to come in, we're never going to climb out of that hole, right? Instead, focus on the asset base, focus on the growth mindset of, I did something. And you know what? Something is so much better than nothing, or something is so much better than doing something harmful.
This one kind of adds to that question. It says, the world is on fire. And for me, one of the worst parts about it is this culture of people simultaneously flooding our social media pages with terrible stories and having a detached, pessimistic attitude towards taking any action to create change. How can I motivate people around me and myself to fix the problems that we see? No one else is going to do it! Exclamation point. So I think the first part of, I think it's part statement, part question, is what do you do when there's all these things on your social media page that you don't really want to see, right? First of all, don't look at them, right? Scroll past them. Just because it's there doesn't mean you have to read it. Two, report things that feel like they deserve to be reported. I feel like that's one like thing that's underutilized. I know it sounds aggressive, but like,
I don't think I've ever reported anything.
I don't think I have either, but I feel like I would. Actually, no, I think there was one time I saw there was a really terrible video that was on my page, one of my pages of something, and I reported it because I was like, I feel like there wasn't a chance for me to choose to watch that, and I felt like it really invaded on my mental space at the time, and I needed some space from that, so I reported that. But that's the only one. And I think that you get to engage with something as much as you do or not want to. And so I feel like it depends on how brave you are. That doesn't feel like the right word. But like, if you have a relationship, I think it always comes down to relationship with a lot of these type of things. Like, if there's a real relationship behind someone who may have posted something like that, like engaging in a conversation with them about maybe ways they can do that in a different way so that it's not just something that's in your face all the time. Like, is there a way that we can have this conversation without you posting this video? Would it have been helpful if you had posted, like, is there a way that we can engage the conversation in a different way? Go ahead.
So I think there was a question about how to use social media as a positive mechanism for change in activism. Yeah. And it gets at that too, right? I think that one, it is happening in small pockets. It's just not the mainstream. So try to seek out those pockets, find where they're happening and follow them, support them, repost their crap, right? And so not crap, good content. But I think it's, and then also just slowly try to shift the story you're telling yourself about social media. You're right in that for many people, it is a highlight reel. How can you use it in a way that's not necessarily like a Debbie Downer? I just learned about Finstas the other day. I'm old now, I guess. So I learned about those. Yikes. Apparently that's like the negative Nancy world. All right, whatever. So I'm not saying you need to turn your account into like a the world is on fire account, but if you can bring in things, right? So when we thought about when the world was literally on fire, when the Amazon was burning, still is burning, question mark. We've moved on apparently in the news cycle. People were posting that on their page. And one of those questions is, does that count as activism, right? Hey, if someone didn't know about it and they didn't see about it, they didn't see it until you posted it, I'd count that. Check. I'll give you a gold star, right? I do think that there are those little things that you can do to show that you're engaging and to encourage that engagement, right? If people see you engaging in that way, they're going to say, oh, it's okay to post that stuff. I'm going to maybe do it too. Maybe it won't be that dramatic, but slowly, 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 that will shift. One of the reasons to
tie this... If that's what you want your social media for, like...
Sure.
I feel like there's only one person on any of my social media pages that I follow that, like, engages with, like, some serious causes. And that's personally because when I'm on my social media, I want to laugh. Like, I want to laugh, and I want to see cat videos, and like funny things, and that's about it. And I think that's my way of protecting myself from like what the other question was about, was like, if I see all these things, like, I just don't want to see them when I am in my few minutes of break time where I want to rest and chill and like do those kind of things. So I feel like know what you want. But this one person, before I let you go back, the one person that I do follow, they're a woman of color who's a professional climber. And that's already like odd. There's not a lot of women of color that climb. And so she posts things with the platform that she has about being... about like dismantling racism and dismantling the patriarchy and talking about capitalism and encouraging her particular community, this climbing community, to be more open and to find ways to integrate and to think about dismantling systems. And I follow that page because I'm like, yes, I believe in dismantling systems. I may not climb, but I see that you are doing something that is very important, which is finding ways for people of color, of people of differently abled bodies to be able to climb and to do something that's a different kind of movement. And so since that reflects back on the things that I'm passionate about in wellness, it allows me to engage in this sort of a social justice movement through her social media without having to post it myself or without having to really engage in things, reading articles and things like that when I'm tired. I don't know.
Last two things. I promise I'm almost done. Yeah, engaging with social media in our political climate in this activist sense doesn't necessarily need to mean you're posting things about the world burning. It could also be you supporting people who are doing the things you like to see.
Which right? is motivating the people.
Exactly. Second thing, social movements, political change, this takes so much time. It takes those little needle pushes. It takes those little steps, right? If you are engaging and you're feeling burnt out, do all the things we told you, because understand that you probably pushed that needle just a little bit, but it is so heavy. You can't necessarily, no one person, leadership doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's all coming full circle. You can't, no one person can shove a social movement into change, right? It's all about those people taking the steps and progressing together.
Amen.
Amen. Okay. So thank you all so much for coming out today. Thank you to Amherst College. Thank you to Kate Rich for editing. We had so much fun.
Yes. Please follow us and subscribe on whichever favorite platform that you are at Attempted Adults. It's never as long as this was. they're usually about 20 to 30 minutes long. So this is probably the longest we've ever talked, not to each other, but just in general over a microphone. And we've had a really good time, and I feel like we've learned a lot, and we just appreciate you coming out. So thank you so much.
So to wrap up the way we wrap up every episode, yours in Attempted Adulthood, Anna.